listeners. This is Carolyn Yeager with another edition of the Heretics Hour, which I expect to be posted on October 26, 2015, in a couple of days. It is currently Saturday. What I'd like to talk about in this program is how everything is managed today. I seem to be noticing that the press is even more managed than it used to be. Everything that's said is managed, and it's very hard to find any real news. What I mean is, when you look to see what the news is, it's all the same, and it's all every news outlet, and there's not that many of them that are really available, are all saying the same things, and all these so-called alternative sites simply pick up their news from the mainstream sites, then maybe comment one way or the other on it. But that's it. There is nothing more available. It used to be that I thought the internet was just a place where I could find everything and anything I wanted, and it was so different from of having to depend on television or the radio. But nowadays, it seems that the internet is gone the same way as television and the radio. Now, it could be that the internet has always been this way, and at the time, I didn't know as much, and so I thought I was discovering things. But when I try to look up things now on the internet that I have never found the information I want on, I think, well, if I hunt for it, I'll find it. No. No, it doesn't seem to be there. And yet, it's real information. I know it is, but it's not there. It's not available at all. And so, I'm finding myself more and more running into a big wall. The fact of the matter is, I can almost get the best information from Wikipedia, which is not much, but you can find a lot of different pages that one thing leads to another that you do get. I do get quite a bit of information, but I don't get what I'm looking for. That's true. And then I have to ask whether what I'm looking for actually exists, because maybe it doesn't. Or if it ever did exist, it doesn't exist anymore. Somebody has hidden it away, and it's not being made known. So unfortunately, I'm feeling that the internet is being quite limited, whereas I used to think that it was just amazing. There was no end to what I could learn on the internet. Well, it's still good. I'm able to follow a lot of things that I've been following lately, which I find of interest. And I'm going to talk about some of those things in this program. But first I want to mention some recent donors, because I don't get much of a chance to do that, and many of them have not gotten mentioned, but I want to thank Richard from Chicago and Nick from Australia for sending in donations, and also my anonymous friend who sent money in the mail recently, something for me and something for Carlos Porter and something for Horst Mahler. And he asked me to get the money to these people, because this man is totally, keeps himself totally anonymous, to the extent that there's not even a hint on the envelope that he sends, which gives any indication of where it's coming from, because he sends a priority mail package. But he's very generous, and I did pass on these gifts that he asked me to do, so I want him to know that. But this also brings up something to do with Carlos Porter. I have for a while been wanting Carlos Porter to translate the speech by Heinrich Himmler called the Freedom Day speech. And this is the one that Veronica Clark has in her book along with the Platterhof speech by Adolf Hitler. I was able to get hold of the Platterhof speech, but I have not been able to get hold of the Himmler speech at the National Archives in the United States, where she said that she got them. But either they have made them unavailable now, maybe because she went and turned it into a book, I don't know, but they're not, as much as I've searched for them there, and other people have too. They're not available now. That part that supposedly would have that speech are not available. Those files that she gives the name and number to are not available. So I gave up on that, but when I was talking to Carlos about sending him this money from the anonymous donor, I brought that up again, and, you know, he had always been kind of, I couldn't quite make out. It sounded like he had the speech, and then it sounded like he didn't have the speech. Well, I finally got it straight that he has the speech on CD disc. But the reason that he said he needed a written transcript was because he doesn't like translating from an audio like that. He wants to translate from the written word. I can understand that after thinking about it a little bit more, but I was like, why, you got it. Just translate it from the disc. Well, I can see that it would be far more difficult to translate from listening to somebody speaking if you're not a native German speaker. As good as Carlos Porter is in as many languages as he knows to translate, he knows how to translate, he's a Native American speaker, and so just listening is a little bit more challenging. Plus, he said that Heinrich Himmler doesn't have good diction. He said he doesn't speak clearly enough for him. It's probably not a very high-quality recording. And he says some of the parts of it he can't understand. He's having a hard time understanding. But anyway, after I pushed the issue and told him that I was going to take up a collection to send money to him for doing this, because I knew that a lot of people would appreciate having this speech and would be willing to give something for it. And I told him that I would hold back the $50, that I would hold back the donation from this anonymous donor until he did that speech. And so now I have another donation too. So I have $100 in the kitty for Carlos Porter, and he says he is working on it, but it won't be done anytime soon. But he is working on it. He has other things to do also. So this is very, very good news, I think. And so I'm asking people who have an interest in this, in having this speech, and it will be then made public, and you will not be hostage to buying Veronica Clark's book in order to read it. So if you want to send a donation to me and mark it for Carlos, do that, and I will keep a record of all that, and we'll give Carlos a nice gift after he has completed the job. And you can send that money to me via PayPal. My PayPal email address is carolyn@carolynyeager.com. Don't forget that. Don't be surprised when you see it's not .net, because I opened that back when I was still calling it .com, and I didn't think it was too wise to try to change it. So, or you can mail cash or checks to the address that's on my website on the donate page. And I want to also tell you about tell you about an email that I got from a listener. And this was back on, this was almost 2 weeks ago, because it was after the last Heretics Hour show that I did. And I talked about Donald Trump a little bit. And this person named Bill wrote to me and expressed what a lot of people feel. I know it's a kind of a spread between those who like Donald Trump and see him as a hopeful appearance on the scene, and those who are already discounting and calling it something that will not do us any good in the long run. Well, Bill writes, "I'm disappointed in you. Donald Trump is not a self-made man." I checked back and I had called him that. He said, "Kindly search Fred Trump, his father. Daddy left Donald millions from his real estate empire. You are witnessing another Jewish show," in quotes, "carefully scripted to use all the right hot buttons. Why do you think Bill and Hillary moved to New York?" Well, I don't know, because it's Jewish? Because it's run by Jews? Is that it? I'm a 74-year-old New Yorker, he says, and former reporter for the Wall Street Journal, among other adventures. And he says he's also a German ancestry. So obviously he listens to my shows and he's liked me, but he's not happy about, he doesn't think I'm too smart about Donald Trump. Well, I did write back to Bill, and we had a little back and forth. And I told him that I think that Donald Trump is good enough as a self-made man, even though he got a very good start. It didn't say he was rags to riches or anything like that, but he got a very good start from his father. But if he hadn't been a very hard-working and smart guy, he would have probably used up his father's money and not gotten very far with it. But instead, he turned it into billions, and he's still going. So I defended him on that score. And the thing about the Jewish show, I understand fully where people are coming from when they say that. But, you know, in the pro-white movement, we have this idea that if someone isn't 100%, then they can't be good for us. Well, you might use this with people within the so-called movement. That would be true enough. But when you're talking about politicians running for an office as high as President of the United States, well, you're certainly not going to have somebody who presents themselves as a white nationalist get anywhere, as we know. And this brings me to what I think is just interesting, that Donald Trump starts out on his political career, the first political office he's ever run for, and it's the highest office in the land, the president of the nation. So that's kind of interesting. I mean, he didn't try to run for anything. He's obviously then not a politician at all, but he is someone who thinks that he can get things done in a lot better way than the politicians have been doing. And that's what everyone likes about him, and that's why even many in the pro-white community see him as a very good thing that has come along, a very good thing that has happened. And in fact, it gets better and better all the time. So I wasn't moved by Bill, and there are others, and another Bill that I know who thinks the same way and thinks that Trump is only going to put off the final, you might say, Armageddon that we have to have in the United States in order to get things going right again. But I don't adhere to that position because I can't imagine that if there's such a crash, I don't think there's going to be a crash like that. I think that the people in power, the Jewish power, really the Jewish money power, is able to prevent that. And they do anything it takes, and they have a lot of plans. They're not going to be caught with their pants down. And these white groups that are looking forward to such an opportunity are not going to have the strength or the ability, the talent and power to take over this country. And it's getting worse and worse. But what we've got with Trump is someone who is giving a convincing impression that he is going to do something about immigration in this country, and not only slow it down, or maybe even pretty much bring it, not stop it. You're never going to stop immigration anywhere, but slow it down quite a lot and stop illegal immigration, but also remove people from the country that are here now. All this is well known, but as far as Trump being a Jewish show that is carefully scripted, I just don't see Donald Trump as being scripted. For one, I think it's clear he's not. It's clear he speaks freely like he's always done, obviously. You know, I never paid any attention to him. I've been aware of him as a rich real estate magnate and a well-known person, but I never had any interest in him. I never paid any attention to him. And I might have thought that his personality was not very appealing at all, and I didn't even like it if I had known him, which I didn't. But it's very refreshing on the political scene, just extremely refreshing. And I'll just say that when I first heard, the very first time it was, I saw that Donald Trump had announced he was going to run for president, I said, oh, good. I said to myself, you know, oh, good. Only because it would give some relief from these boring, horrible politicians, and they're worse this year than ever, than they've ever been, and they've been so bad before. I mean, it's just excruciating, and you have to kind of, you don't have to pay attention to it, but you can't avoid seeing stuff about it all the time if you're someone like me who's always looking at the news pages to see what's going on, so, and to find things to write about and talk about. So it was like, it wasn't about anything but that, just that, oh, it'd be somebody, and I thought right away, I'm going to vote for him. You know, if I get a chance, I'll vote for him because I don't want to vote for any of these other people. So it was just that. However, now he does seem like a serious entity who can really do something. So he's not scripted, and I don't think he's trying to push buttons that he doesn't believe in himself. I think he's been engaged in his business endeavors all this time and probably didn't even think about running, you know, politics. But something changed, his age maybe, and at the time he's like, well, now I've done everything I would want to do in business, and I can use this to help my country. And I think he's a sincere patriot. That's the impression I get. While he was never anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic, and he's not now, but he's certainly not catering to the Jews. And it's the Jews are the very ones who are so against him. And this is, again, not anything that most of you don't know, but this is an interesting phenomenon. So this is what I wanted to focus on mostly, is how they are trying to bring him down. And, you know, the media, I talked right in the beginning about how the media seems to be one entity. No matter what aspect of it you look at, they're all saying the same thing. And they're all trying to bring down Trump. They're all trying to ridicule Trump. They're trying to tell you that he can't last, that he could never be president. Even Barack Obama, our current president, made the statement that Donald Trump will never become president. What kind of statement is that for him to make? What is it? It's not up to him. Of course, he's not saying he's going to stop it, but he seems to think that they're all saying that. That's the mantra. It comes from the Jews, too, that we don't want Trump, and so let's say anything and anything we can to convince people who might put some faith in us, whoever is speaking like Obama, to turn away from Donald Trump. And Donald Trump has to be aware of it. He intimates that he's aware of it, but he doesn't come out and attack the press or the Jews or anything like that. He just keeps going. I don't know what he would do if he would start losing. He might start, maybe he would, but he doesn't need to at this point. But in the many election cycles that I've been through, and I don't think there's been any election cycle that I wasn't pretty aware of what was going on, even if I didn't really follow it that much. A few times in the past, I've usually gotten caught up in, you know, presidential elections one way or the other. I try not to. I haven't now lately, but now this with Trump in it, it brings something altogether different. And I have never noticed any time when a candidate was so attacked and was so degraded. Well, there was such an obvious campaign that was so widespread to talk people out of him. And it, you know, there might have been party politics where one party was really trashing the candidate of the other party and things like that. But this is being done by the media before you really get going with it. It doesn't at all appear to be some kind of a scheme, some kind of a scripted thing to make us all believe that they don't want Donald Trump when they really do. No, I don't think they can be that clever. And I don't think that's going on at all. It doesn't even appear to be and doesn't feel like it at all. What it feels like is that this is the year, the time of the outsider, because people are really fed up. They're not only fed up with the politics and politicians and Washington politicians, they're fed up with the media too, and people know what the media is today. And it actually always has been, but we just didn't have the insight in those days. So while we live in an incredibly managed world, Donald Trump is not part of that managed campaign that's going on in presidential politics. It can be called the fear of Trump. And the Republican Party itself is trying to take him down. And they will take anybody now rather than Trump. They will take Ben Carson, who couldn't be a good president. Well, I guess it's always possible for there to be surprises. But I don't want a black president myself. We've just had one for 8 years. So that puts him out for me. But for the other people, it's surprising how well he is being accepted, as though we can just keep having black presidents in this country. That's another thing about Trump. He's a real white man, and he knows he's a white man. He's one of the few who are up there in the world who does know it. You know, he's half German. I always heard that he was Scottish, but it turns out that his father was German and his mother was Scottish. He was born in New York City. He always lived there. So he didn't go there in order to, get in the big time or something. It's his hometown, actually. And even before he graduated from Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania, he had gotten money from his father and he invested it in a housing project, which turned a very nice profit 10 years later. So he always had his eye on being successful. And there is nothing wrong with that, since most of our politicians seem to want us to be unsuccessful. And Trump is also saving us from the likes of these Republican candidates, one of which is worth a damn. And mostly he's saving us from Jeb Bush, who I suppose, without Trump having gone into the race, Jeb Bush probably would have just slid along. Nobody would have thought there could be anyone else, because everyone else was on a lower scale than Jeb Bush at that time. And this Jeb Bush is really the worst thing. He makes me puke. He's so pathetic. And he seems even more so now because he's come up against Donald Trump. And what's on the other side? Hillary Clinton. And so here we have a choice of Jeb Bush, Hillary Clinton, or Donald Trump, really, in the big picture. And what would you take? How can that be something that the Jews have set up? Or have the Jews set up Donald Trump to go up against Hillary Clinton, thinking that he would be easy for her to beat? I don't think so. Or if they did think that, well, they've had an awakening, and that would be one reason why they're now trying so hard to bring Trump down. Trump says things that shock everyone, things that have never been said, that things that none of the others would ever say, and then they think, boy, he's done it now, and he just comes out smelling like a rose because he's right. He tells the truth, and he's right, and he also has very good instincts about people. Everything he has said about the various people that he has supposedly insulted, it has been, it rings true particularly when he talks about the lack of energy of Jeb Bush early on. And that just really, I think, took the wind out of Jeb's sails, because he tried to act energetic and was so phony when he tried to do it. And now Trump is saying that Ben Carson lacks energy too, and he does. He does. Well, Barack Obama, being young, he was one of those that thought he could just act cool and didn't have to do much, and people thought he had some great wisdom hiding behind all that. Well, we found out what he could do, and that's what the rest of them would be. That's what Ben Carson would be like. Well, in any case, Ben Carson could never beat Hillary Clinton. Never. So we're just fortunate that this golden boy has shown up, and it seems to be someone who really is on the side of white people. He really is. He might be okay with Jews. He's not going to go up against Jews, but he doesn't see Jews as being the enemy of white people. However, he does go up against Jews when he talks about building a fence and when he talks about immigration in the way he does. He knows they don't like that, but they can't say anything, really. I don't know they do say things, but they try to make do it in a way that he simply isn't qualified, or he has the wrong kind of personality to be a president of the United States, in which you have to behave like a big hypocrite that, you know, and never shake anything up or never rock the boat at all. That's what they're trying to sell to us. Then Trump goes after George Bush on 9/11 and comes out a winner. And when troublemakers cause trouble at his rallies, they want to cause trouble, he has them removed. And he always makes the right comments about it too. And he always turns out to be right. And people love that about it, because he's thrown that political correctness out the window. And it's something that everybody likes. Except for the lefties, of course. Because that's what it's there for. Political correctness is there for them. It's there for the left. And that's why they're so upset about it. And they're the ones who are trying to get rid of Trump. And Trump has said friendly things toward Vladimir Putin, and I'm glad for that. He's done a very good job in talking about Putin. But I want to bring up something that he was asked about this Malaysian Flight 17 crash. The results of the test done by the Dutch government stating that the plane was likely shot down by Russian-backed separatists on Ukraine soil, in eastern Ukraine. And even though Trump said clearly in the interview with MSNBC that it was probably Russia, it was probably people involved on the pro-Russian side who brought the plane down, what he said about that was spun by almost every media that exists as having him saying that it wasn't Russia, and saying that it's unknown and you can't blame Russia for it. That's not what he said. And the only news outlet that I noticed that got it right from the start was the one called The Hill, which is an old news outlet for organization that covers the Capitol in Washington, D.C. because it's on a hill, the building. So it's the congressional covers the U.S. Congress. Well, what I want to say is that then Andrew Anglin on his Daily Stormer also spun this to make out that Trump was exonerating Putin, which Trump never did. And I'm saying this in connection with the fact that the Daily Stormer tries to make Putin into a hero. More than is honest, than can be reliably shown, because they like to promote heroes there. Andrew Anglin likes to promote people as heroes or villains. Nothing, no gray space in between. So in this case, Andrew Anglin quoted from two Russian sources for his story, which appeared on October 18th on the Daily Stormer. He quoted from the news source Sputnik and RT, and both were saying essentially that we can't blame Putin, that Trump said that we can't blame Putin for the crash. And Andrew ends up writing this. Okay, he started out by saying, "Today the Donald is calling out the Jew agents accusing Russia without any proof of downing MH17. I don't think the Donald was doing that at all. But Andrew ends the article by writing, "Tying it on Putin, a white man who comes across very well to Western audiences, even while speaking a foreign language, is ridiculous. Once more, the Donald has successfully managed to allude to a serious issue in America with just a few simple words. It sure does feel good to finally be winning." He takes hold of whoever he thinks he likes at the moment and puts himself right next to him there and on their side and makes out that he's part of what they're doing. But in any case, he completely ignored what Trump actually said in the interview, and the interview was available to watch. It was a video, and you could see exactly from that what Trump said. But that was all passed over. Well, what did Trump really say about the Malaysia Flight 17? As I said, only this news outlet, The Hill, got it right from the start. Some of them finally got it right, or they just didn't write about it anymore. But they said, "Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump says Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 was likely shot down by Russian-backed separatists." And then they quote him to show that what they're saying is true. They quote Trump, "It was probably Russia. It was probably people involved on the pro-Russia side, but..." And then he puts in some, you know, he says, saying things like, it's really not going to do us any good to go into it or to push it. But then he said in another place, he says, "Probably was Russia, but at the same time, it's a long ways away, and we have to get back to making America great again. We have to get back to building our infrastructure, etc. We just can't fight with everybody. There are only a few people who know, including Putin, and we know he's not going to be talking about it." Well, that's interesting because he's acknowledging that Putin is not going to tell the truth about it. He's acknowledging that. He thinks it's Russia. Putin knows. He thinks it's the pro-Russian side. That's what I think. The pro-Russian rebels, they shot that with that Russian missile that Putin or his defense leader had sent that equipment in to Ukraine, and they were using it, and they were reckless with it. It's understandable. I can understand it. They're not professional soldiers. They may have been some professional Russian soldiers there. Maybe they were just supervising, and maybe aren't the ones who actually shot the missile. But and so the Russians have denied it, and Putin has denied it, and they've come up with all kinds of theories about why, all kinds of them, other theories to show that it was the Ukrainians who did it for one reason or another. But the facts have always spoken for themselves, and it's always been pretty obvious, and now the Dutch, who you can trust, have determined that it was a BUK missile launcher that launched that missile and that hit that plane. But the Russians, and this is what bothers me about Russia and about Putin, who fits in with all of that they will deny it, and they will continue to deny it. And as Trump admits, it's going to be very hard. It's not hard to prove that it was that, or to pretty much, maybe the proof isn't all that definitive, but it's there. But what you're not going to get is for Russia to admit it. I think that's what Trump understands. And that shows, that tells me he's on the ball. He understands a lot of things about psychology of people, and he understands Russia and the way it's been. Whether it was the Soviet Union, whether it was under communism or not, it's always been the same. They don't worry about not telling the truth. And that's a defense that they go into. We saw it with Katyn. The tragedy, the MH17 tragedy is like Katyn on a much smaller scale. But Russia always denies, always has, as I've said, and it always will, I guess. Even after the Katyn murders were proven to be their responsibility, they denied it until the Soviet Union collapsed. That was about 50 years or longer. And they'll deny the Malaysian plane attack too until Putin is gone and an opposing regime takes over, probably. Then they might admit it. So I don't know. Is that a Slavic thing? I know the Poles are real good at denying the truth too and denying the facts if they think it's in their better interest. Oh, and another post that Andrew Anglin wrote at the Daily Stormer that contained misinformation, that because it was taken superficially and he just took the news accounts of something and then wrote his own account of it from that and didn't have the actual information because he doesn't know enough and he doesn't spend the time on what was said there. And this was about the speaker at last week's Pegida demonstration. The speaker with the unpronounceable last name, the Turk named Akif Principi, I'll say. There was a misunderstanding about who he was referring to when speaking about the concentration camps. This was an article from October 21st titled, "The Concentration Camps Are Unfortunately Out of Action at the Moment." Andrew wrote that he was calling for the reopening of concentration camps to put those migrants in. But see, no, he wasn't. That was a misunderstanding. In his speech, he was calling for the kind of tongue-in-cheek, calling for the reopening of concentration camps to put the Germans in who were not going along with the program, like himself and the people at Pegida. That's what he was saying. He wasn't implying to put the migrants in the camps. He was saying that too bad for the authorities that the camps no longer exist so they could put these bad right-wing Germans in them. That's what he was actually saying. So Andrew Anglin puts out a lot of misinformation because he doesn't know any better and he's not careful enough and he doesn't correct it because he still doesn't even know any better. Everything goes by him so fast. He's just whipping things on there. So that site, I must say there's a lot of good stuff on there, or it seems to be good. It's at least resisting. There's good to say about it, but it's not anything you should ever rely on. As far as the information that put out there, when it comes from Andrew, part of the reason that Andrew makes these errors is because he wants to say the things he's saying because they fit his agenda. So, back to Trump and his comments on Putin. This is something that I think Trump recognizes, and he didn't put a false face on any of it. He was really handled it very well, I think. So I'm real happy about Trump. I continue to be happy about Trump, and I don't think the idea that he's going to put off our having a white takeover of this country, I just can't follow that at all. I think that Donald Trump is our best bet by far, and who would even have thought that someone who's been talking and acting like him, that we would ever see this scenario? Who would have thought we would have seen this scenario? And this brings me to another thing I want to emphasize in this program, and that is the need for leadership. It takes a person to come forth, a person who is able to exhibit leadership and take charge of something and lead the people, and then things can happen. Then things can happen. As I alluded to earlier, if Trump had not decided to run for president, what would we be looking at today? Ugh, ugh, just really horrible to consider. So we're fortunate. And I don't think, though, that white nationalists who are known, including myself, should be publicly promoting Donald Trump. I don't think it's good business. I think we should just be quietly promoting and just, you know, amongst talking about it or whatever. People can't stop from talking about it. But I don't think it helps Donald Trump for David Duke to endorse him. Now, I think me talking on this program, I considered that, but I thought nobody listens to my programs except people in the know, and there isn't, I don't have any big reputation or anything, so it's okay. I actually had determined earlier that I was never going to talk about Donald Trump, even though I liked him from the start. I thought, I'm not, because I didn't know what would happen, you know, in the beginning you thought, God, anything could come up, what he might do, he might go bad, or he might turn stupid or something, and so that was part of it. But then it was, you know, I'm just not going to say anything. But it's hard not to. It's hard not to because it's so interesting. The whole unfolding of this has been so fascinating. You know, as I say, amongst a bunch of bores. So he's brought life to things, and it's hard not to want to talk about it. But the leadership thing, yeah, it's without a leader, nothing happens. Here you had, we can see that we had all these people in the United States with these views, with anti-immigration views. Just put it that way. There's other issues too. And even you might say racialist views, concerned about the decline of the white race in this country, the numbers. And that, there's a lot of people, but it took someone who could come out and vocalize it in the right way for people to come out and have someone to be for, someone to follow. People need that. Nothing happens without a leader. Now, I've said that before over the years in shows, always usually making the point about Adolf Hitler because he was such an incredible leader and how it's not good enough for people to just say they believe in something because it's not going to make anything happen. There has to be someone taking action. That's the other thing about a leader is that they take action in the real world. Donald Trump is very much involved acting in the real world. He's not on the internet. He didn't put up a website, and I'm a website person, so I'm not necessarily putting that down, but that doesn't do it. You know, and we have a lot of white nationalists who are just on the internet, but they're not good enough leaders anyway, so they might as well do that. Anyway, Trump is out there in the real world, and there's someone else who's doing things in the real world that I want to talk about next, who I see him also as an example of how it takes someone acting as a leader to cause followers to show up that you didn't even know were there. And that man is Lutz Bachmann, the founder of Pegida and the current leader of the Dresden Pegida movement, you might call, or phenomenon. If you're not familiar, his first name is spelled L-U-T-Z. That's kind of a short German name that's fairly common. I don't know if it's kind of a nickname, maybe, in Germany, but Lutz Bachmann was also born and raised in the city in which he is now active, in Dresden, Germany. Not at all like Trump, not at all the same type of man, at all. But he also exhibits leadership and is able to draw people out in the same way. People have confidence in him. Now, Lutz had a working class upbringing, and he has a spotty history, done a lot of different things, moved around, gotten into trouble. Supposedly, he has 16 burglaries on his record. They couldn't have been too big, or he wouldn't be out, wouldn't have spent. I think he spent 2 years in prison once. and the rest of it is little things. And he's done a lot of different things. He lived in, he ran to South Africa to get, when he was sentenced to prison, and he spent some time, a few years there. He opened a nightclub and did some other different things, but they came for him there. They finally caught him there and brought him back to Germany, and he did have to serve 2 years. And then he became the owner of a public relations and advertising company in Dresden. And from that, he founded that in 1992, and he's been a publicist and so on. And then he got the idea for this Pegida stroll. He was strolling through Dresden with a friend one evening, and he got the idea for having a stroll, getting more and more and more people to anti-Islamization of Germany, of Europe, and he named it with that P-E-G-I-D-A, which now they're emphasizing the E-G-I part of it, putting that those letters in red, which was Europeans Against Islamization. But that's the key part of it, Europeans Against Islamization. Or you could put it another way, the Against the Islamization of Europe, which makes a lot of sense, Against the Islamization of Europe. Who in the world would want Europe to be Islamicized? And we know that Muslims are very much like Jews in that once they get a foothold, they are ready to take over. And we've also seen Muslims cooperating with Jews very, very well against white people, against European people. But if you ask, why did this thing take hold in Dresden, of all cities in Germany, and not somewhere else? They've attempted to have it in other cities, and they're still attempting it. They do have what they call chapters in other cities, and they've made an effort, but they've not had the kind of success, not even close to it, that keeps occurring in Dresden. So why is Dresden successful? The answer is because of Lutz Bachmann. Lutz Bachmann is there. He's a leader. He's a real activist. He's got that, what it takes. He's got it. He's in Dresden, and so Dresden is successful. He's made it successful, I would say. He's got a lot of help now. He's got good help. I don't mean to downplay the people he has there. I'm not the only one I'm really familiar with so far is Tatiana, but I'm aware of the others, and just recently, because I've gotten interested enough to study their Facebook pages. But this is it. You know, some people have that leadership ability. They just have it. And then, you know, in the case of this Lutz, he has not the best past. And then they try to use that against him. In fact, he's got charges against him right now, but it's for stuff he's written on his Facebook page. Can you believe that? You know, that's in Germany. Germans are doing that. So they want to take him down. There's no doubt about that. And they will do everything they can. They're much more capable of getting rid of people in Germany than they are in the United States. We have too many freedoms that the Germans don't have. But one thing I want to say before I forget is that you can't be a leader on the internet. You have to be out in the real world. You have to be organizing in the real world. That's what leaders do. You don't do it on the internet. You can be an influence on the internet, but that's about it. But the powers that be are very afraid of Pegida in Germany. You know, it's not an organization. It's not a political party. It's just a happening. But it's been extremely successful, and they're still working at spreading it around into other places. But like I say, you need leadership, and it takes a lot of work. Well, the right things have to come together. But I hope that they do expand in these other cities, what with this refugee business getting worse and worse. You know, here I want to interject something again so I don't forget it. That I read recently that there were 100 gymnasiums, these must be school gymnasiums, that have been taken over for the migrants, for migrant housing in Germany so far. And when will they ever leave, you know, until they, when will they find, till they build special housing for them, which they plan to do. So here you have all these schools where these kids go to school. Just think about when you were going to school, your school gymnasium, all the things that took place there. They can't be used now. No gym classes, no sporting events. Well, we had basketball games in the winter. And any other things that would that it would be used for, school assemblies, sometimes it is. And then there would probably, in a school that had this, probably they would get the students to spend part of their time taking care of these migrants and serving them and cleaning up or serving them food or what have you, and call it some kind of good educational effort for the students. Good for them. It's good for them to do that. Good to teach German kids, even more so, how to serve the rest of the world. That's just what they need to learn. I found that just absolutely shocking. I mean, just to think of what Germany is doing and why. And nobody wants to think about it. They're afraid to think about it because of the political correctness. So the message is, get used to it. Germany doesn't belong to Germans anymore. Well, and in the United States, the message has been, get used to it. The U.S. doesn't belong to the white founding race anymore, or the white founding Anglo-Saxons anymore. Get used to it. But Trump is saying, well, he thinks it does. And Lutz Bachmann is saying that he thinks Germany has gone too far with this, and he's doing something about it, thank God. But we need to organize more. Without organizing, because the other side is organizing constantly. They have so damn many organizations. And one of these is something that functions in Germany is called ProAssel. ProAssly. ASL, short for asylum. So there are what they call themselves a human rights organization. And they campaign for the protection and rights of persecuted people in Germany and Europe, by which they mean to keep migrants and foreigners from being persecuted. And they're especially working, of course, with people who are seeking asylum in Germany. They've probably got similar things in other places, particularly in France and Britain. And this organization was founded all the way back in November 1985, and it was two people. One was the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Germany, and the other was Dr. Jürgen Mitsch of the Evangelical Academy in Tutzing. So there, you know, he was an evangelical preacher, I guess, or a religious figure. And then the United Nations, they're both the same. They get along just fine. Everything about them is left-wing do-goodism. You know, take care of everybody. Protect the persecuted. Well, these people who are coming to Germany now are supposedly being persecuted in their homelands. So they have a right to go somewhere else because of what they're suffering in their homeland and the places where they go, which don't have war or other type of things going on, have an obligation to take them in. This is what they say, you know, this is what they promote, this is what they teach. But how this works for the receiving countries is something else again, and that's not given the same kind of attention that we can see that, you know, that we're in the news are always showing children amongst these refugees or men holding up their child. And they do that on purpose, knowing, saying, here's children, because they know what people think when they see children. They are not going to say no to children. So, but I want to tell you about a couple of examples of how this works in Germany. You may have heard about it already or read something about it, but it's good to emphasize it. I think it's just so revealing. This is the story of the little village of 4,000 people who were who are scheduled to receive 3,000 migrants, or refugees, as they're called in Germany, from the Refugee Coordinating Committee of the capital of their state. This is the kind of narration of what took place in the village of Langenlonsheim in Rhineland-Pfalz, a village of 4,000 inhabitants. And this is kind of a narration that was translated for a group, a website, by a woman named Faustina. And it starts out with the refugee coordinator from the state is in the village. And the mayor says, "It is definitely rather venturesome of the administration to simply make decisions for our location. It is not a good policy." The person telling the story says, "To begin with, Langenlonsheim is a village in Rhineland-Pfalz with 4,000 inhabitants. The problem, 3,000 refugees will be arriving in only a few days and will be housed in this empty building. The interaction between the placement officials and the local citizens who shall ultimately be responsible for welcoming the refugees. The citizens of the town only learned by accident that this building should expect to house so many refugees. And the first person to fall from the clouds this morning is the mayor, is the mayor himself. I go to meet Mayor Michael Tupala and talk to him about 3,000 refugees that are to arrive in mere days. The news nearly blew him over, he explains, and also that he was even able to catch wind of the operation. That is, he just happened to hear about it, sort of like. The mayor says, "The middle of last week, the rumors came to me. It was said that the decision to use Langenlonsheim was concrete. Then Mr. Plasek called me on Saturday to let me know that a large number would arrive. But nonetheless, it wouldn't have hurt for the officials to speak with us first to determine our situation. And as you can see, we are not on the edge of the town. We are directly in the middle. The potential for conflict is already pre-programmed." The refugee coordinator for Rhineland-Pfalz is here, Detlef Platzek. Sudden and spontaneous citizens' protests appear on the other side of the street. Despite their extreme upset, they appear to be of goodwill. Yes, Germans are of goodwill. So one man in a car says, of those ones across the street, says, "No, 3,000 is too many. Maybe 1,000. And someone asked, "What would be okay here?" A man on the street says, 200 to 300, I think. 10% would be a fair solution, but more than that is a ghetto, and we don't want a ghetto. Then a man with the bike says, "I haven't even had any bad experiences with refugees." So either the mayor or the coordinator says, "So you are positive on the issue?" But the man with the bike says, "Yes, I am positive, but not for 2,500 or 3,000, or even more than that." Just this Saturday, the refugee coordinator communicated with the mayor that he would be coming to see the area himself and determine if 3,000 refugees would be too many. "Which criteria do you use to make the determination?" he was asked. Plastek answers, "If this bordering neighborhood is unified to accept the sheltering of refugees and just how many, but you must give me the chance to look at the place. I haven't been able to see for myself." "Happily, we will simply tag along." And then the observation begins. Plastek says, "Okay, that is the building Delphi. Then comes the living area." Mr. Plastek will check out the area for the living quarters. It is directly next to a neighborhood. "You are now deciding on the exact number of refugees, so 900 plus 1,500. What are you deciding on now?" Plastek says, "Yes, I am determining the overall size." And he's asked, "And are you going to look inside the buildings to see where the refugees will sleep?" Plastek says, "No, I already know enough information on that end. When it comes to possibilities for housing refugees, if I may be so bold, that is a piece of cake for us. The entire infrastructure is already available, and we have water, functioning fire alarms, large open areas, So according to these points, everything can be checked off. And the mayor says, and so you have already spoken with someone here and tested the conditions? Plastic. Naturally. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. There is no discussion to it. The other says, no one here has spoken with him or Plastic. I personally? He walks off. On Saturday morning, yes. That's a bit late, isn't it? The mayor agrees, yes, good. That is so. I would have liked to know about it sooner. That is right. With the expectation of housing 3,000 refugees, this is an understandable wish. The first person to learn the result of the visit is, of course, the mayor. Now, Plastic says, the coordinator, I unfortunately cannot pay any attention to the ratio of refugees to inhabitants of the town. It isn't possible. And for that reason, I have informed the local authorities that I will suggest to the state government that they stay under the level of 1,000 and that they should avoid building tents, and should there be any changes, to notify the local authorities by letter by the middle of next week. And so the plans to house some 3,000 refugees here are for the time being suspended, but there are still some 1,000 refugees to be allotted to the small town. The mayor does not believe that this is the right strategy for success if the public is to play a role. The mayor says, I hope that they can learn from this. While the problem of dimension is currently solved, but this is only an initial welcome center, the problem is national, and in the future I hope the national authorities will act differently, especially with all the pressures we have here. We must act, but not like this. This was only a local meeting, lasting only 2 hours, but I find that he has told of many things that could have gone better. So you can see that the Germans don't seem to be in the least bit racist. They're very willing to help these people, but they understand that if they're overloaded, it's not going to go well, and they don't want that. They are very upset about the numbers, and that's Merkel's fault. I wish they would be more upset about people of such a different culture coming and people who will be wanting to build their own religious facilities like mosques and so on and run the town for their own benefit and their own interest and according to their own culture. They don't seem to grasp that yet, and I know that Germans are trained to not think that way and to feel that that would be wrong for them to be concerned with such things. But they do know that it's not going to be good, but they're afraid to say much. Even you hear how that mayor is so polite, and he's trying to put things into friendly words. And this is what the German authorities, let's say the German political class, now expects from their German masses. They don't expect any talk back at all from them. They're supposed to accept everything and carry on with such a good demeanor and so on and be so polite all the time. And if anybody speaks back to them, they take it as horrible behavior that should be shamed, and even criminal charges are going to be brought against this person for hate. So this stands out to me, how Germans are unable to stand up for themselves except for the few who they call right-wingers, who still have a concept of national identity and that the German nation means something to them. I'm sure you've already seen the video from the town hall meeting in Lohfelden, Germany, which is near Kassel, which is the main city there. I don't know if it's the capital of the state or not, but they had a meeting, and in this case, they are a town of 13,000, which is small, but not anything like the 4,000 village, but they're only expecting 400 refugees. They are only informed the night before these refugees were to arrive, and they are quite upset about that. And so they call this meeting, and this regional governor from Kassel, the larger city nearby, very close, Walter Lübcke. This is when he told them that they could leave if they didn't like it. The translation goes like this. He said, it's so great that this country meaning Germany, has values, and these values make it really worth it to live in our country. We need to stand up for these basic values, and anyone who decides not to stand up for these values has the right to leave the country or the state if they are not in agreement. It's the freedom of every German. Huh, the audience is taken aback and they start booing, some of them, and some say, no, no, they can't, you know, they can't believe this guy is saying this. In fact, somebody in the audience said, I can't believe it. Lübke tries to continue. He says, we have freedom. We have a democratic system, the majority. And then it's inaudible because one audience member says, what democracy? So they want you to write to Lübke and tell him what you think, and there's contact information for him. But this fits with what I'm saying, that they expect the people to accept whatever they do and not to complain, particularly if they can be called a racist if they do, or a xenophobe. Now, the people in Germany won't read about what's happening in these towns, in other towns, in their media, unless there's some very small independent media or on the internet. And a lot of internet is blocked off, too, in Germany. So while they know what's going on in their own town and they don't like it, or their city, or they might know more about what's in their state, they don't really get the picture of everywhere as they should if they had a free press, which they don't. So we're back to the managed news and the managed society, the managed world that we live in today. It brings me back to that subject, and it's really heavy. It's very heavy. Thank God we have a few leaders that can help to rally the people that are rallyable, and those people are in a minority, I think. I think the left is in the majority almost everywhere. Another leader I really should make mention of is Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who has really done incredible good here in this situation. So if you want to say, who is the trifecta for me right now? Who are the big three that are doing the most good in the world today, as far as I see it? And it's not that there's others who aren't doing a lot of good, but right now the three that stand out to me are these three: Donald Trump, Lutz Bachmann, and Viktor Orban. And you know, the AfD party in Germany, I'm all for that too. The Alternative for Deutschland. They're doing really well. I follow what they're doing. They don't have anyone who stands out, though, in that way yet. But they do have some good figures. They have that guy named Gauland. He's very good. They're having, the AfD is having a big rally in Berlin. I think it's the 28th of October. So I'm looking forward to that, and gosh, I just hope they have a good turnout. They're going to be inundated with the counter-protesters, with the Antifa, or some people call it the Antifa, who will show up there against them. Then they have to bring out thousands and thousands of police officers to control these events. And it's not because of the right-wingers. It's because of the left-wingers who are so violent. But they never will say that in the regular news. They'll just talk about the violence and leave you with the idea, because they only see the right-wingers as wrong. So they leave the readers with the idea that the problem of violence comes from the right. But it doesn't, ever. It comes from the left, always. In fact, at last week's Pegida demo, there was one person was seriously injured by these counter-demonstrators who, this one was with an iron bar. I think he was hit with an iron bar. And you don't hear about that, but you hear all about that mayor from Cologne that got stabbed in the neck. She didn't die. She's recovering. So it wasn't a good thing, I know, but what about this person that got hit with an iron bar and sent to the hospital? Well, you're not going to hear any sympathy for that whatsoever. Well, they say that when things We've always been hearing this all along, that when things get bad enough, leaders will emerge. Well, right now, some leaders are emerging. I don't think we can say that things are not bad enough yet, because they are very, very bad right now, and yet some leaders are emerging. So we can be thankful for that. What we need to do is to appreciate these leaders. We need to do everything we can to help them along and to respond to what they're bringing to our attention, and to be grateful. And we need to be organized. We need to be organized. And as I close this program, I'm looking at the news and seeing that it appears that in Poland, the election is underway and is showing that the conservative Euroskeptic Party, that has been out of power for the last 8 or more years, is going to win the election over the pro-European Union Civic Platform Party, which is the party of Donald Tusk. That's good news. That is good news at this juncture because of the situation that we're dealing with. So I thank you for listening once again. This is Carolyn Yeager. The date is Monday, October 26, 2015. This has been the Heretics Hour. Take heart, and good night for now.